This is Aiden and Mike with OddballPilot.com, and it's rare that Mike and I get to do an interview together, but we've got a fellow named Cloud Dancer who flew in Alaska back in the 70s and then moved on to an airline career, and he also has a series of books out called the Cloud Dancer, The Alaskan Chronicles. He contacted us a few months ago, and if he liked our website, and I'd actually read some of his books in the past, so we've sort of been trading emails back and forth on the Oddball Pilot Network, and we finally found a way to sit down and do a phone interview because, you know, pilot lives being pilot lives, we didn't ever manage to sit down in person. So we're going to talk about Cloud Dancer's early career in Alaska, the transition to the airlines, and his series of books, and why he wrote them, and what he wants people to get out of them. So, Cloud Dancer, let's start at the beginning. When did you first get interested in flying?
Well, first of all, I want to say hi to both of you guys. It's great that we can finally have this conversation, although I wish we could do it in person. And all my friends just call me Cloudy, so I'm going to think you guys are probably pretty nice fellows, so just call me Cloudy. It'll be a lot easier that way. When did I get started flying? Well, I actually took my first flying lesson about a week after my 13th birthday. I quit the Boy Scouts and joined Civil Air Patrol because back, that would be, what, 1967. Back in those days, the Boy Scouts, they didn't even have the Explorer Air Scouts. And the Civil Air Patrol, you could fly, take flying lessons in their airplanes when you were 13 years old. And, of course, I'd been, at that point, I'd already been waiting about 8 years to get around to it. So,
what plane were you flying then?
Well, my very first flying lesson was in a Civil Air Patrol L-4, which is the military designation for a J-3, and I think it had a 65-horse engine. And, you know, flight instruction in Civil Air Patrol, particularly at a young age like that, was sporadic. I eventually, you know, got a job pumping gas when I was a junior in high school at one of the local municipal airports and started seriously taking flying lessons when I was 15. By the time I was 19, I had my commercial, and I was almost finished with my instrument, but instrument rating, but they were two separate ratings back, you know, in the other century a long time ago. So I ran out of money, and Mama and Papa Cloud Dancer were mad at me because I quit school, so they weren't going to help. And so I was actually, believe it or not, going to enlist in the U.S. Army Warrant Officer Candidate Program at the age of 19 to go be a helicopter pilot and then transition to the Army fixed wing. At least that was the plan. And as fate or a higher power or just chance would have it, I was sitting at a Denny's restaurant on my way to the Army recruiter's office for the fourth and final time. I actually had a 2 o'clock appointment to sign the enlistment papers. And into this Denny's restaurant, several thousand miles away from his home, came Dan Gunderson, or that's what I call him in the book, an Eskimo pilot from Kotzebue, who just happened to be in town to earn his multi-engine rating in a DC-3, and he was looking for a place to have dinner and lunch, and he happened to come into the restaurant. We sat down and started talking, and I missed my appointment to sign up with a recruiter, and the next thing I knew, I was going to Kotzebue based on the caveat that he wanted me to finish my instrument rating prior to showing up in Kotzebue, which I did. I had a very nice designee who was kind enough to get out of bed one morning at 6 o'clock, actually, in the morning on July 31st in Fort Worth and show up at Meacham Field, give me my instrument check ride so I could proceed direct from Meacham Field to Dallas-Fort Worth International, and 16 hoours later I was in Kotzebue with a sum total of 243 hours in my logbook, and as my second boss liked to say, I came down the rear air stairs of the Alaska Airlines Golden Nugget 727 waving my license for the dual purpose of both showing it off and drying the ink.
What year was that, just out of curiosity?
That was July 31st, 1973. And I remember we left DFW that afternoon, and I believe it was 116, which is very hot for DFW. No, it was 112, because it was exactly half of that. 16 hours later, when I got to Kotzebue, it was 56 degrees on July 31st, and I'm going like, are you kidding me? Don't you people know it's summer? So that was, you know, that was the first thing that hit me. So that's the story of how it started and how I got there.
Hey, what did you, before you went up there, did you know much about Alaska and flying in Alaska, or is this totally out of the
way? You know what? That's amazing. It's really amazing because I was desperate to find some way to fly. And, you know, back in those days, pre-internet days, everybody read Flying Magazine. And I read Flying Magazine, and I had read about every couple of years, Flying Magazine did a story about Canadian bush pilots or Alaska bush pilots, but it was nothing, absolutely nothing that even remotely crossed my mind as something that I could do. Or I just didn't think of it. And like I say, what do you call it, you know, the hand of God, fate, chance, whatever. The fact that Dan Gunderson walked into this Denny's restaurant at precisely that time, you know, from Kotzebue, Alaska, it changed my life. As a matter of fact, my entire life has been that way.
But you were saying that the other day when we were talking, that you've had the Forrest Gump life experience.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if Cloud Dancers Alaskan Chronicles, you know, we're working on a Hollywood project. If it happens, I swear I'm going to go legally change my name to Forrest Gump, because my entire life has been Forrest Gump. It's just absolutely amazing. You know, if you read the books, I mean, the things that I lived through, it's just amazing. So, what can
I
tell you?
So let's go back to your early Gump days then, back when you first showed up in Kotz. You were 19 years old.
Looked like I was 16. I shaved once a week, whether I needed to or not. Skinny as a rail. I was the least experienced professional pilot, if you want to call me a professional pilot at that point. I was the least experienced pilot for hire in that town by a good 5,000 hours, the youngest by 7 years of age, and it was just amazing. Of course, they made fun of me and laughed at me. I think I was the third pilot ever brought in from the lower 48 to fly in Kotzebue, and if you read, I can't think of which story it was, but anyway, there was one guy previous to me, but he only lasted like 3 or 4 days. So he didn't really count. But the bad news is he was also from Texas. Yeah, so that, you know, that was a mark against me right there.
Well, that's pretty good. So what did you, when you first show up there, you got 250 hours or something, and what did they put you in to fly? Did they keep you on a tight leash, or was it kind of just jump on a plane and go, boy, go?
Well, it was kind of interesting because, you know, these guys had, the Gundersons were essentially Bush Pilot 2.0 or possibly 2.5, the Gunderson brothers, because their uncle had started flying up there in the late 1930s. And, you know, like many Alaskan children who grow up in airplane families, they could fly long before they could drive a car, or they possibly hadn't even driven a car. So, but they weren't flight instructors. They just innately knew how to fly because they kind of absorbed it by osmosis from their uncle. So they did know, and I had flown with Dan Gunderson after we left that Denny's, and he had already agreed to hire me. I said, "Well, hey, don't you think we ought to check? Do you want to see me fly?" And he goes, "Oh, yeah." He says, "That'd probably be a good idea." And so I ran out and got a Cessna 206, which I had all of about 3 or 4 hours in. And at that point, to me, was the equivalent of what a 747 might be now. I mean, we're talking heavy metal.
Yeah, no, I know so, that feeling, actually.
Oh,
that.
Yeah. You know, and of course, he said, "Oh, great. I know, you know, we got 206s. I know how to do that." So we went and flew around. So he had an idea that I had the basic concepts of lift, thrust, weight, and drag, you know, kind of nailed down. But I remember I asked him when we got out of the traffic pattern, this little interview flight, if you would like to call it that. I said, "Well, where do you want to go? Do you want to go to the practice area? You want to see me do stalls, steep turns? You know, what do you want?" He really didn't know. He says, "Well, have you got any short airports around here?" And there was actually...
You're like, "Yeah, we got one that's 3,000 feet long. That's short."
Yeah, that's it. I mean, there was actually one that was 2,800, but I wasn't going to, you know, risk going there. But I did...
In a 206.
Yeah, I did know where there was a nice, you know, 3,600-foot strip, which... or 3,200-foot strip, which to me I thought was pretty short. So we went over there. It was Mangum Field, which is long gone now. I think it's a housing development. And it was like I said, 3,200 feet. I think it was 60-foot-wide asphalt. There was a, you know, a cow fence, a cow pasture fence on one end, all of about, oh, maybe 5 or 6 feet high. So we're on base leg, and he says, "Let's make that fence like, oh, maybe 20 feet instead." And I said, "Okay." So I did my textbook absolute best high performance, in my mind, short field landing. I did my best short field landing, you know, laid on the brakes, came to a stop with a good 500 or 600 feet of runway left. And taxied back, and did then my absolute best textbook, lower 48, this is what they teach you in flight school, short field takeoff, and got it all cleaned up at a couple of thousand feet, and I looked over at him, and he hadn't said anything, and I said, "Do you want to see me do it again?" And he says, "No, that's okay." He says, "You can take me back to meet you," and I says, "Okay." He didn't say anything for another couple minutes, so I looked over at him. I said, "What do you think?" And he looks at me, he gets this little Alfred E. Newman grin, and he says, "Yeah, we can teach you." I'm like, "Okay." And I had no idea. One of the most interesting things happened when we got back to Meacham. We taxied. They have a motel there on the airport, and that's where he was staying, or at least they did back then. We taxied up into his room, or we taxied up right by his room and parked. We went in, and the room was all littered with all the materials he needed to do his ATP and the DC-3, and he took me over to the table, and he opened a Gnome sectional, and he says, "Here, I'll show you where we're going to go, or where you're going to be," and he opens this Gnome sectional. Now, bear in mind, the only flying I've ever done is, you know, Dallas-Fort Worth.
Yeah, super busy.
Yeah, well, not only that, but when you open the Dallas-Fort Worth sectional, there's stuff on it.
Yeah, the roads and houses and...
Yeah, and the little antenna theories and railroads and like, you know, the yellow stuff that indicates a town, a city? There's like whole dime-sized yellow and quarter-sized yellow. So he opens this Gnome sectional, flips it over, and points to Kotzebue and says, "Here, this is where you're going to be." And I'm looking for the yellow, and there's no yellow.
Not even in Kotzebue.
And I'm looking for, like, nav aids, and there's no nav aids. You know, there was the Hotham Beacon, 356. It's locked in my brain forever. On my deathbed, I'll remember 356, the Hotham Beacon. And I'm like,
I think that's still there, although they've slowly been taking all that stuff out.
Right, you know, and so I'm looking at this going like, what is going on here? Well, the phone rings, and it turns out to be his brother, and he gets on the phone, and he's talking to his brother, and he says, oh, just look at the map. Here's the Kobuk Valley, and these are the places we're going to go, and this is where you'll be flying all the time. And I'm looking, and if it's possible, these places are even smaller than that Kotzebue place, whatever it is, which, you know, I can't believe. And I'm listening to the conversation in the background. I'm trying not to, but the short version is his brother is calling to tell him that one of the other pilots in town just got killed.
Flying or with it?
Yes, no, he was flying. He got killed in an Aztec in Cayenne.
Okay.
And so here I am, you know, kind of all excited because I got this flying job and I'm going to Alaska and I'm going to be a bush pilot. And the first shock I get is there's nothing on the map, and I'm still trying to absorb that as I'm overhearing this conversation he's having with his brother, which doesn't sound good for somebody, and then he puts the phone down, and he comes over, he says, yeah, he says, I should probably tell you about that, to be fair, he says, you know, this is kind of different, he says, this guy just got killed, and, you know, actually, we're going to be really busy, so I need you to finish up your instrument rating and get up there as soon as you can, and I'm like, yeah, okay. So
yeah,
that was a big shock or a speed bump.
Yeah, even today that's still I think the accident rate's down a little bit, but it's still pretty significant in Alaska. And actually just recently I walked in looking for a job and I was talking to the chief pilot and they had a call in that they just had a midair while I was talking to him, a similar situation.
Yeah, well, that must be the midair that we're both familiar with. The accident rate, the fatality rate has dropped dramatically, especially if you average out the last 4 years absent the summer of 2011, the summer of 2011, which was a very bad summer. The accident rate has actually, I believe, the fatality rate has actually dropped in excess of 40%. The flying has matured tremendously. The technology, you know, I mean, the first thing I had to do was memorize every field elevation, every runway heading, every escape path off of the end of every runway, how many seconds, not DME, but how many seconds on your Timex you had to fly on what heading. To make sure you didn't smack into anything while you were, of course, quote VFR unquote.
Yeah. Yep. They.
So it's gotten a lot better.
Well, and the other thing that's changed a lot, and this is a jumping head to a little bit, but even from when I started, it's gotten a lot better. And the technology changed, but I actually think what helped a whole lot is there are fewer operators right now from when I showed up. And I know this was a lot different in the 70s even. There's less of a push to get in the air, and the reality is the pilots do not take off in the same type of weather they used to take off. I mean, you might end up in the same weather, but people are much more conservative about leaving their base, and I think
yes.
That actually made a big difference. And a lot of that, there's not quite as much vicious competition between companies. So
part of it, surprisingly enough, and I didn't really know this until I talked to some guys in the last couple of 3 years. In those days, when I went up there and flew, I mean, we got what was then a very, you know, substantial dollar rate, you know, for the early 1970s. I spent my first winter, by the way, getting back to the original question, flying in a Skyhawk.
Okay.
Actually, it was a Skyhawk. It was a 145 horsepower Cessna 172. It had no navs and no comms. It did have an old coffee grinder ADF. I don't know if any of our listeners, how many of our listeners know what a coffee grinder ADF is. Do you guys know what a coffee grinder ADF is?
I do vaguely. but I couldn't give you the specifics.
Well, let the old fella tell you about it. the coffee grinder ADF, back in, it's just got a little knob on it that rotates. It's on the front face. It's called a coffee grinder because that's how people used to grind coffee beans, and people still grind coffee beans that way. As a matter of fact, if you grind your own beans, sometimes. Well, no, now the electricity does it for you. I'm sorry. What am I thinking? But the coffee grinder ADF, behind the window, there was a horizontal drum, much like the old directional gyros were a horizontal drum, and the numbers rotated from the right side of the window to the left. The drum made a circle behind the window horizontally. So you follow me there?
Yep.
And the way you moved the drum and changed the frequency was there was a little knob, no bigger than an inch or two, a couple of inches, that you just rotated in a circle. So it was called a coffee grinder ADF. So that was the only piece of navigation equipment I had in my Cessna 172. But the thing is you didn't ever want to move that little coffee grinder knob and get it off frequency because, number one, the speaker was broke, and the overhead speaker was broke. It didn't work. And there wasn't another NDB for, what, how far is Nome, 176 nautical?
Yeah, that's
so,
about right.
Yeah, there wasn't another NDB for 180 miles in any direction, so you really had no reason to move the knob to begin with.
And yeah, the mountains between you and Nome.
Yeah, there was no heater, and you had to remember the artificial horizon was off 10 degrees to the right when you were straight and level. And that's what I spent my first winter in, flying out of Kotzebue. And their attitude was, the Gutterson brothers, their attitude was, you know, we know he knows how to fly a Skyhawk, so we'll throw him in that. And if he lives through the winter, we'll give him a real airplane in the spring, maybe.
So, yes, I'm not going to go too far into your Alaskan career, because I think people can read your books to get that, because you cover your career. I mean, your stories are actually, and I think I said this to you yesterday, what I like about them is that a lot of them are pretty tongue-in-cheek. They're humorous, but they actually get across the feeling of what the flying is still like out there, even with GPS and modern navigation aids. It's still pretty similar to that in a lot of ways. And so I think if people really want to get a feel for it, the best way to do that is probably to dig into your books, or we'll be here forever going through every story. But you flew out of COTS for a long time. You were there from 73 then until the mid-80s, right?
I left Kotzebue in July of 89, yeah. And
okay.
Actually, in that 16 years, it also encompassed 6 or 7 months out of Unalakleet, a couple of different stints flying out of Nome. Probably one was 6 months, so maybe a year out of Nome, 6 or 7 months out of Unalakleet. Spent a lifetime one summer in Bethel, and spent another lifetime in Barrow one winter. But majority, probably about 80% of my flying, it was all north of the Alaska Range, 100%, but 80% of it, was out of Kotzebue and the Kobuk Valley, which to me is still home, and I miss it desperately, and it is so beautiful.
Oh, Kotz is one of my, I always say if I showed up in Kotz when I was 19, I'd be there still, and I'd have 5 kids, and that would be the story of my life right there.
Well, when I tell people, you remember the movie Stand By Me, by any chance?
Yep. Yep.
And do you remember the poster, the movie poster, the promotion where it showed the four young boys walking down a railroad tracks with their arms around each other's shoulders,
Mm-hmm. Yep, yep.
If you can just envision that, when I got to Kotzebue in 1973, it was like, if you could imagine standing in the middle of railroad tracks and off in the distance a couple of miles or a mile and a half away, you see the caboose receding in the distance. It's going away from you.
Yep.
When I got to Kotzebue in 1973, it was the very, very, very tail end of the era where the bush pilots were literally the right hand of God. And there was no higher social status for a female, you know, north of the Alaska Range. I mean, even being the governor's wife wasn't as good as being the girlfriend or the wife of a bush pilot. I mean, it was just such a high social position. And the relationship between the pilots and the people that they served was tremendously personal. And that is something that several people that I'm proud of, I will say it, I'm proud of it, that several people have told me that one of the things that comes across in my book so well is the relationship between the pilots in those days and their passengers, who were really their friends.
Yeah, and you go back to the early stories of in Alaskan aviation, you know, the 30s and 40s, and you get that same feeling. And
oh yeah,
I would have to agree that I think that's faded quite a bit. I mean, the pilot took a lot more planes, pilot turnover's significant. Now we talked about a mutual friend of ours in Nome who's been out there for his whole career.
Oh,
and
yeah,
and
the man is incredible.
Yeah, and I think he maintained that relationship. You just talked to agents about him, and he would show up and. Different. You know, I was going in a hurry, but he'd show up and he'd stay there and talk with them for a while. And I mean, he's one of my friends.
Not just talk with them. I mean, there were times. See, the thing that was different then is a tremendous percentage of our work in the pre-deregulation days in the 70s was charter work, and because of the lack of navigation aids, because of the lack of radar, it was not at all uncommon for an airplane to not show up in a village for two or three or four days if there was a storm, you know.
Right. Yep.
And back in those days, the scheduled service, when I was there, the Golden Triangle, Norvikan and Selawik, you know, they got an airplane every day from the airline. One. That was
right.
It. Sometimes two. Sometimes they'd have an afternoon Golden Triangle, too. Ambler, Shemnak, and Kobuk, they got three airplanes scheduled service from the airline, three Twin Otters a week, and that was it. So a huge, huge amount of our flying, the majority of it was all charter flying. And many times, particularly in the earlier days, the customer would pay to keep the airplane on the ground at the village. So it was not unusual for me to take a trip and spend 8 or 10 hours in a village waiting for the customer. So, you know, it's not like I just slept in the airplane. I mean, I was in people's homes. I was playing basketball at the school with the kids.
Well, that brings up a thought that I've often said that, you know, people, you'll see PFA, I fly in Alaska, and they'll be like, oh, so you're a bush pilot. And in my mind, I always say that being a bush pilot really refers more to an era than it does to the job description. And,
I can't agree with you more.
Okay, good. But I feel like it's kind of over. It really, you're now an air taxi pilot.
I think it's been over for about two decades, maybe two and a half. We started trying to shy away from the even using the term bush pilot by the early 1980s. It's nice to, you know, puff up your chest and, you know, impress some chick at the bar and say, yeah, I'm a bush pilot. And that works real well in places like, you know, Dallas or Memphis or wherever you are. But, you know, you do that in the bar in Anchorage or Fairbanks or somewhere, somebody's liable to say, no, I don't think you are, because I know some real bush pilots and you're not one.
Yep, that's been my feeling. Now, that being said, having gone a bunch of places around the world and seen flying in different spots, and there's still places left to hit. In fact, Jim Tweedo, I was talking to him, and he said he thinks there's some spots in South America that are like Alaska used to be. But by and large, I still think Alaska is one of the better places to fly. The pilots still have more responsibility for their own plane than in many other places in the world where people are flying.
That hasn't changed. I agree. That hasn't changed. And that, you know, you hit on something very key is you know, a pilot's responsibility, his personal responsibility. You know, I fly this huge airplane with sometimes 184 people on it, and I sign the logbook, and I'm responsible for it, but there are, you know, a dozen strangers loading it. Sometimes I know the guy that's working on it. Sometimes I don't know the guy that's, you know, signing off my squawk and working on my airplane. And there is still a very tight relationship between the pilot and his mount in Alaska, and it's an important one.
Yep. The other place I saw when I was flying in Nepal, I felt that it was had a similar type of feel, which I kind of liked. So let's move on just a little bit. As we kind of, like I said, we're going to skip over your absolute Alaskan stories a little bit because they're all in your books. But what prompted you to go to the airlines? What prompted you to leave Alaska and go fly on the island?
Well, you know, ever since I was in diapers, both my parents worked for major airlines since before I was born.
Okay.
So, you know, when I initially, you know, went to Alaska on July 31st, 1973, when I walked down the jetway at DFW, I had every intention of going to Kotzebue, wherever the hell Kotzebue was. I was going there, my plan, 6 months, make some of those big Alaskan dollars, get some hours in my logbook, and then I was going to, you know, come back to America and, you know, get on with my life and go be an airline pilot, you know, which means I should be retired from American by now. Well, I'm sure a lot of guys are wishing that, they were this week. But unfortunately, the third night I was there, I discovered the bar, and then I got a little confused and fell in love with a gorgeous little Eskimo girl, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Right, and the next week you fell in love with another gorgeous little Eskimo girl.
Well, it wasn't exactly next week. I might have been 2 or 3 weeks.
Well, so, and you were there for, I mean, that's darn near, that's 16 years that you were flying in you know, Western Alaska.
Yeah.
And so you clearly liked it, and but you still
I fell in love with it. I fell in love with it. I just probably the neatest thing is like the third night I was there. Have you flown up there in Kotzebue during fishing season?
Oh, I've flown up there. Yeah, I've spent several years in Kotz.
Okay, so you know how it works on the ramp, you know, with a forklift running around with the totes of fish and everything.
Yep.
The third night that I'm there, now bear in mind, you know, my Mama Cloud Dancer worked for Delta and Daddy Cloud Dancer worked for American. And that's what I grew up with. They couldn't afford a babysitter. I was literally raised at the Delta Airlines hangar at Love Field in Dallas and the American Airlines hangar at Amon Carter Field in Fort Worth, which is long since gone. So, I mean, this was my whole image of flying, and it was, you know, this is what I grew up with. This is what I aspired to. This is the whole thing that I thought it was all about. And when I got off, you know, when I got off the airplane in Kotzebue and I looked around, I thought, holy crap, what have I got into? Well, the third night I was there, which would be what, August 2nd or 3rd, you know, 10:30, 11 o'clock at night under the midnight sun, in comes this Wiener Alaska 737-200 combi. The guys wheel into the parking lot there on the west end of the ramp where the Wien terminal was at the time. And I'm just out, you know, slumming around. I don't have any flying to do. And I'm just trying to still get acquainted with my surroundings. I see the 737 wheel up, and the guy, it shuts down. One L opens up. One L is the forward left-hand door. A guy in cutoff jeans and a T-shirt and a baseball cap and sunglasses leans out and, you know, pulls open a handle and then turns around, and next thing I know, this huge door is opening up on the front of the airplane. And then he disappears in the cockpit, and I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. They fly around, they got their own loadmaster. Well, somebody trundles up a set of stairs to the front door, and that guy gets back off, and one other guy gets back off dressed just like him. You know, and they both got on Ray-Bans and T-shirts and shorts and tennis shoes, and it turns out they're driving the airplane. And I'm going like, holy crap, that's the airline I want to work for. I mean, this is airline flying. And so, like, that was, for at that day, my whole, and then, of course, I fell in lust with this, I mean, love with this, you know, gorgeous girl. And so the next thing I knew, it was like, you know, 16 years later, and I pulled my head up off the bar and said, okay, where the hell was I going when I got here?
Okay, there are downsides to flying out in the bush, too, and that's, you know, I always say that, you know, the airlines have downsides, but they're steady, it's good pay, and the time off's usually good, and it's hard work flying out in the bush, and there's, you know, I don't think I could go to the airlines. I like flying, you know, I like the bush-type flying, but I recognize that there are huge advantages to flying for an airline.
They both got wonderful advantages and they've got, you know, they've got disadvantages too. I mean, I'm really struggling with this because, you know, the equipment that I'm flying today is by far the best equipment I've ever flown. It's the best maintained I've ever flown. I make, even though I'm one of the lowest paid major airline pilots, I make what most people would think is pretty doggone good money.
Yeah.
And I get more time off than, you know, I've ever had. And those are all good things. But there are things at some point, and I'm reaching that point in my life now, where the money's not the most important thing. You know, the equipment is certainly important, and the maintenance is certainly important, but those things have come a long, long way in Alaska since I've been there. I'm struggling with you know, what my future holds, and I know there's downsides to flying in Alaska. A lot of them have been mitigated. I don't think it's nearly as risky as it used to be by any means. The equipment's improved a great deal. I mean, my gosh, you can't get out of radar contact in Alaska anymore.
And of course, that's also taking some of the fun away from it, honestly.
And it also takes some of the flexibility away that we used to. Flexibility,
absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. That's even changed.
We used to be able to get away with a lot of stuff you wouldn't try to get away with today.
I mean, that's even changed since I showed up there. You know, overall, Alaska does have to advance and come into the modern age, so all that's sort of inevitable. And, you know, I've kind of recognized that from I had my little break and going back. You know, there's significantly more paperwork now, and it's frustrating, but it's the way it is going these days.
Well, a lot of that, you know, is just simply liability issues. And that goes as far back as probably the late 1970s, early 1980s, we were starting to get a taste of that. You know, we kind of touched on it a little bit earlier with the bush pilot thing, and there was this bush pilot mentality. And one of the things I didn't bring up is that would be of interest to oddball pilot listeners is that the pay system now is one of the things that has helped make Alaska safer. As you pointed out, pilots don't take off in the kind of weather they used to take off in. In the early 70s, when the competition was fierce, and I mean really fierce, we would steal each other's loads and all kinds of stuff. There were actually two outfits who their one of their certificates, I believe, was taken off the wall by Fairbanks Fisdo, and another one was threatened, and they got the message. But there were two outfits who would not pay you if you did not reach your destination. And guess where their passengers and pilots kept dying?
At their destination.
Within the last 10 miles of their destination.
Yeah.
Because they've flown 200 miles, they fought their way there, and I'll be damned if I'm going to turn around now. Boom.
Yeah.
Okay. So now we've got a new way to pay pilots that takes the pressure off of them, and that's a good thing. We've got better equipment. We've got better maintenance. But I think we've got a better attitude. We've got a better attitude by the operators, and it was forced on them as early as the late 1970s, and it's been a couple of decade maturing process since then, a three-decade maturing process since then. But as early as the late 1970s, we were killing so many people in the late 1970s. You know, the dedication page of Volume 3 lists 16 of my dead friends and roommates. How many years was I there? You know, that's one a year. As late as in the late 1970s, we were killing so many people because the pipeline explosion, the explosion of money and the flying just went crazy. We went from not being able to have enough flying to more flying than we could possibly stand. If you were only flying 125 hours a month in 1976, you were screwing off. I mean, a good month was 140, and, you know, that was normal. And a lot of times we did 160. I think my record was July of 1977. I did 207 hours in 28 days.
Yeah, that's a good stretch.
You know?
When I started, I worked for a company that was kind of a throwback to those old days, and it took them a few accidents and the feds getting involved for them to, their attitudes changed dramatically.
I bet I know who that is, but we won't say, will we?
Yeah, no, keep that one quiet. And they were great to work for. I mean, I loved working for them, but it was definitely a little bit more of, you know, get the job done type attitude.
Yeah.
And I think all that's changed across the board up there. I mean, you still find it in really small operations.
And the other thing is, but the other thing is the passengers themselves have become more aware that they are entitled to a certain level of safety and assurance when they travel.
Oh, absolutely. Yep. I think teachers these days are actually taught some very basic regulations so that when they get on a chartered plane or a scheduled flight, they've got an idea of what they're looking at, which is, of course, terrifying from a pilot's perspective. You don't know who's going to turn you in for something you couldn't avoid. But,
right.
They're getting more knowledgeable, for sure. Before we go too long on this, and then we'll move on to your how you got into writing. So someone is starting off, and I found this even more on the Oddball Pilot Network, because I'm starting to answer people's questions, and it seems to me that it really depends on the personality, on what company they want to end up. So do you have any advice to someone who wants to fly in Alaska and how to get up there to fly, or what the best procedure would be, and maybe what they should even consider, whether it's a place they want to fly or whether they should just maybe head towards the airlines?
Well, okay. I'll try it. Bearing in mind, I'm sorry?
I said that was a lot to throw at you there.
No. I can talk about the fact that, you know, Kotzebue doesn't have bars anymore, you know, but that's not really what we want to talk about.
There's plenty of alcohol in Kotz still, let me tell you.
Yeah. And I know how it gets there. I'll try and tackle it. Because even though my information, my knowledge of some of this is 20 years out of date, the majority of what I'm going to refer to now hasn't changed, because it's about lifestyle and how you want to live your life. For one thing that has changed that has made it better is there are companies that allow pilots to work 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, or 3 weeks on and 1 week off, so that if Kotzebue or Nome or Barrow or Bethel isn't your cup of tea and it's not what you want to do, well, you're not, quote, stuck there, unquote. When I flew in the country, there was no such thing. Your job is here. It's in Kotzebue. You work for this company. And, you know, when you get 3 or 4 days off, if you want to go to Anchorage or wherever it is you want to go to, then knock yourself out, and good luck getting 3 or 4 days off to do it. You know, so the scheduling has improved. So you have the ability to move in and out of the remote areas if you choose not to live there. If you're the kind of person that loves to be in the outdoors, then that's one thing. If you're not the kind of person that loves to be in the outdoors and you need, you know, a selection of 4-star restaurants to dine at, and you like to wear Gucci shoes and stuff like that, well, you're not really a Kotzebue or Nome person. A big thing is, are you single? Are you married? Do you have a girlfriend? Do you have a boyfriend? Kotzebue, Nome, Barrow, Bethel, they can be heaven or they can be hell. But one thing's for certain, either way, guaranteed, it will have an effect on your relationship.
Even if you're doing a rotation, like it's just your whoever you're with has to be okay with what you're doing.
Absolutely. And we had, in the days where we lived in places like Kotzebue and Nome, when we were there all the time, and, you know, you'll find the same thing, that fellow we were talking about in Nome, just ask him. You know, how many great pilots did we have, guys that would have been great if they were alone and single, and they had to leave because their spouse couldn't deal with it because there was no mall. There ain't no Starbucks. I'm sure they got espresso machines in Kotzebue now. Even though I haven't been there since '89, I know they got espresso machines. But
they come and go. They stay in business for a year, then they go out of business. And
well, that's typical. Kotzebue has always been that way. So it's essentially there's two things to consider: what kind of lifestyle you want to have, and what's important to you in your lifestyle, and whether you want that to be long term or short term. Do you want to do it for a year or two? Or do you want to do it for longer? And the other thing is how much, what's your sense of adventure? Because the work is harder. Flying in places like Nome and Kotzebue, I mean, I'm sure a lot of your listeners have watched Flying Wild Alaska. You know, there's work involved. You're throwing triple mailers of soda pop. You're spending a whole day throwing, you know, eggs and soda pop and bags of flour, and it's, you know, 50, 60 pounds at a whack. So it's kind of like, if you're not really into getting your hands dirty, this isn't the place for you. We had guys, I remember we had a guy back when I was flying Islanders in 77, we had a guy that said he was a pilot, it was beneath his dignity to wipe oil off the airplanes. And I said, well, you don't have to ever worry about wiping oil off these airplanes again because your ass is fired.
It's a blue collar flying job.
Yeah, it's a blue collar flying job. I mean, I will tell you this. My airline right now, as a matter of fact, I'm going into recurrent training tomorrow, so I really should be studying, but whatever.
Good luck with that.
But my airline is starting to put, because of the Air France incident, my airline is starting to put hand flying back into the training syllabus on one of the most automated airplanes in the world. They're gonna train us now how to hand fly it. And ever since I've been flying this airplane, they keep trying to beat me over the head to make me turn on more and more automation. And the world is finally recognizing, as a matter of fact, Boeing, Honeywell, at Airbus have been in a study for a number of years now trying to figure out if pilots are getting too far out of the loop. And what I'm talking about here, guys, is basic flying skills.
Yep.
Lift,
if we actually
thrust,
had a, we had a, we'd oppose
lift, thrust,
oddball
weight,
pilot about
I'm
that.
sorry. I'm sorry, yeah. Lift, thrust, weight and drag, pitch and power have not changed since Kitty Hawk. But pilots are not taught how to fly anymore. They're taught, they get out of their 152s, and from then, I haven't looked at a 152. I see glass in 207s now, which just absolutely baffles me. But pilots that are starting today are not being taught how to fly. They're being taught how to be a systems operator. And one thing that Alaska has always been great for is you will learn how to fly. You know, even if you got glass in the cockpit, you're going to get some stick and rudder skills or you ain't going to last.
That's it's so funny. I mean, Mike hears me grouch about that all the time, flying these G1000 equipped planes. Oh, my goodness.
It lasts for a lifetime. You guys remember Use More Flaps?
Remember what?
Do you guys remember the story Use More Flaps?
I don't. Not off the top of my head.
What's that?
They're not off the top of my head, no.
You need more lift, you put the flaps down. You need is the runway disappearing beneath your nose and it won't quite fly, then you put full flaps down.
Yeah,
you need to stop flying, then raise the flaps. I can't tell you how many times, you know, it was a matter of using full flaps, no attack. Well, that's where I wrote that part of the story about no attack. But the use more flaps trick, it's really funny. I taught it to so many guys in everything from Cessna 206s to Bondurantes over the course of my 16 years in Alaska. And when I explained it to them and told them what we were going to do, they looked at me with this, huh? The same way I looked at Dan Gunderson when we were going to take off out of NOATAC with 13 of us in a sled. And I said, how's this going to work? Because it's taken almost full power to taxi. And that's when he explained the use more flaps thing to me and then demonstrated it to me.
I mean, along with that, it's just plain common sense. And I think we're beating that out of people to some degree. But, yeah, to add more flaps if you're not getting off the runway, running a runway, it should be a common sense instinctual thing.
Basic flying skills. But the funny thing, the funny part I wanted to tell you, is I got caught in a real bad situation in Vegas along with about two dozen other airplanes a few years back in my Airby, my frog jet. And we made two landing attempts on 2-5 right. And one time I got the right main gear on the ground and we still drug it sideways. Well, by the time we got done with the second go around, there wasn't enough gas left to go anywhere else. So I said, okay, here's what we're going to do. And we did the old dump the flaps trick.
Yep.
And when I explained it to my first officer, he looked at me and said, you're going to do what? And I said, we're going to do this. And the flying skills, the aerodynamics are the same, you know. And what I was going to say is a buddy of mine, one of the guys that I taught it to back in the early 1980s, I ran into him at the Captain Cook in Anchorage a few years back, and he says, hey, you remember that use more flaps deal? And I said, yeah. He said, yeah, we used to do that at Hawaiian on the DC-8s, too.
it's almost
know,
like when Tex Johnson rolled a 707. You know, it's still an airplane. Just as big doesn't mean it
that's
doesn't
it.
Work.
And so if you go to Alaska, if you want to have the sharpest flying skills, if you really want to say you're a pilot and not a systems operator and you take pride in your airmanship, and that's what you want to be proud of, not the shiny wings on your double-breasted, you know, black blazer and the four stripes of gold, that's fine to have that somewhere down the road, but first learn how to be a pilot. If that's what you want to do, then go to Alaska.
Yeah, I would concur with that.
So when you moved to the airline,
I'm curious about, you know, how you felt about the change in lifestyle. We talked about the self-reliance and, you know, all the good things about flying in Alaska from a piloting perspective. There's obviously positive things about flying for the airlines, including
absolutely,
the technology. You get to fly amazing equipment, go places. But coming from that Alaska experience, what was it like to lose the self-reliance, to lose the VFR, to lose the short legs up and down all the time?
Well, as far as the lifestyle, it was a big adjustment. You know, the old saying is you can take the boy out of the bush, but you can't take the bush out of the boy. And, you know, to a certain extent, I mean, just even the way I dress, you know, was different. And the idea of putting on a shirt and a tie and epaulets and all the other stuff was so alien and uncomfortable to me. And I said, can't we just fly around in, you know, sneakers and jeans and crap? But, you know, and that's part of the reason why I have to go back to Alaska. I've tried for 22 years, and I'm still a square peg trying to fit in a round hole. I mean, I found my niche, and I thought it was time to leave, and I'm glad I came to be an airline pilot, and I've enjoyed it. And the people I fly with, the people that I jerk gear for, that I was a first officer for, and the people that fly with me now as a first officer, these are some of the best people I've ever flown with, and they're really great. And you know, I've got a nice benefits package, but it's a different mental attitude. I mean, the first thing they had to do really was beat the bush out of me. You know, I got hired at the airline as a sim instructor on the Dash 8. When I left Kotzebue, I wound up within a matter of weeks in training as a simulator instructor for this airline on their Dash 8s. And this is an example. So by the time I show up at ground school, I probably got, I probably had about between 12 and 14,000 hours of flying in Alaska, of which a good 7,000 hours was in the single engine column. So that was, you know, all single pilot. I think I had maybe 2,000 hours as part of a two-man crew in Alaska, and about half of that as captain. So now I'm down here at this big, big airline that's got even 747s, and they've also got Dash 8. So I can say who it was. It was America West. And so, you know, they're a, quote, big-time airline, unquote. Matter of fact, shortly after I went to work for them, they were classified as a major airline. And they've decided to hire me and teach me how to be a Dash 8 instructor for the simulator, which means that I have to qualify and get typed in the airplane and so on and so forth. So my first school that I went through was as a new hire, but as a captain. And for those of you that don't know what a CPT is, it stands for Cockpit Procedures Trainer, and it's basically a mock-up that doesn't move. Sometimes the lights come on, sometimes they don't. In our case, they were just huge life-size color pictures, and we would touch the switches, but of course we would be touching a photograph. But nonetheless, we're sitting in this thing, which is cockpit sized, and my instructor, who's already determined that I am, well, he's trying to make a, what's that, trying to make a purse out of a sow's ear or something, silk purse out of a sow's ear. I mean, he could tell he's got his work cut out for him, but he can also tell that I know something about flying. So there's this very complex approach into Flagstaff. And the final approach course is on a VOR radio. And the final approach fix is a defined, you know, that little carrot thing on the Jepson plate that says where the final approach fix is, and it's X number DME. You guys follow me
yep.
so far? Okay.
Yep.
So we're flying this approach in a cockpit procedures trainer and talking ourselves through the approach, and he says, okay. He says, you get to the missed approach point, and you see the runway. Are you going to land? And I says, yeah. And he says, where? And I said, on the runway. And I'm leery because I'm thinking this is a trick question. So I go, on the runway? And he goes, where on the runway? And I says, oh, I don't know. It's a -8. I'll get her down in the first third, I'm pretty sure. And he shakes his head, you know, shakes his head, looks down, and I'm thinking, well, that must not be the right answer. And he says, do you know what a visual descent point is? And I said, well, I'm guessing it's where you see the runway in descent. He goes, no. He says, and then he tells me how to calculate a visual descent point. No, he says, and what's your sink rate going to be? Or what's your rate of descent going to be? And I said, oh, it'll be pretty steep at first, but we'll shallower out there at the end.
It'll be whatever we need it to be.
Yeah, you know. So he explains the whole concept of the visual descent point and explains that in order to do a stabilized approach, by the definition of the company ops manual, a stabilized approach, that while the missed approach point may actually be at 5.0 DME, if you cannot see the runway by 5.7 DME based on your ground speed, you're not going to be able to make the landing or leave minimums. And I kind of sit there and let this sink in, and I look at him with this look on my face. He says, okay, let me get this straight. I says, I'm going to take this -8 with 38 people up here, and I'm going to fight my way into this miserable place, and it's horrible and it's stormy, and I'm going to get to the airport. I'm going to get to the missed approach point. I'm going to see the runway, and I'm not going to land. Is that right? Do I understand this? And he says, yeah. He says, that's the way it works. I says, and you guys are going to pay me? And he's like, totally. He just looks at me, and, you know, you can't take the boy out of the bush or the bush out of the boy. So, you know, they had to literally take the manuals and whap me upside the head with them, you know, almost every day to get me to absorb it.
One thing is, I had an exact same experience when I was doing my 1900 type rating and on the engine out, circle the land, and I exceeded 30 degrees of bank and then landed. And they said, well, if that was your type ride, you would have failed. You exceeded 30 degrees of bank. I said, you've got me engine out in bad weather. I'm circling land, and I land the airplane, and I fail. And they said, yeah, you should have gone missed approach. Well, missed approach with an engine out, that just seems even stupider. So I 100% sympathize with your situation.
I remember one night going into Redmond, Oregon, in a Horizon Air F-27, off of the DME arc to a VOR approach with an engine out. And, you know, I'll bet neither me or the captain thought of that 30-degree bank rule. I'll be damned.
Yeah, no kidding. It also brought up another question I had. It ties into a theory I've had, but you've seen more with the airlines and who they hire now. I've always thought a year or two flying somewhere like Alaska can help you get a job at an airline, but if you go too long, if you stay in Alaska for 10 or 15 years, it's no longer viewed as an asset. And it almost can work against you because they want to see someone who fits into their environment. Do you find that to be true at all, or have you seen anything that might indicate that?
Well, number one, I think very much, guys, it depends on the individual airline.
Okay.
Man, when it comes to pilot hiring, it is like black magic. I mean, once you get away from who you know, and never doubt that who you know plays a role. But once you set aside the who you know factor, which is what generally can help move your resume to the top of the pile. Definitely it's certain airlines. Once you leave the who you know factor, guys, it's black magic. If I knew the answer, I'd be a rich man.
That's it. But I've seen airlines hire people, and you're like, really? They hired that guy, and they were right there with someone else who's excellent. And you're like, you didn't hire this person, you hired them? That's weird.
I swear, that's every airline, regardless of the background. I've seen it in every case. Possibly the one difference is Alaska Airlines, I think, recognizes the value of bush flying more so than other airlines do. And if there is any airline that would not consider an extended stint of bush flying as a negative, it would most certainly be Alaska Airlines. Certainly, Era Alaska, I'm certain, would not. But if you're talking, you know, the major airlines, then it's a different story.
Yeah, okay. Cool. Let's, before we go too long, let's kind of just talk about your books, because you're sort of following in the footsteps of, there's a long history of writers and pilots. What prompted you to start writing your stories down and getting,
you know, it was a Forrest Gump moment. A good friend of mine told me about a website called supercub.org, which you could consider to be the delivery room for Cloud Dancers Alaskan Chronicles, the little baby that became Cloud Dancers Alaskan Chronicles, if you want to look at it that way. I call it the birthplace of Cloud Dancers Alaskan Chronicles. And how it happened is a friend of mine said, hey, you need to go check out this supercub.org. There's a lot of Alaska stuff on there. And he recommended a specific forum, which I went and read, and I got done. And it took me a couple of days to read all the stuff. And I said, yeah, that's really cool. I wonder what else they got. And they had this forum on their website called Lighter Than Air, which, of course, is pilot humor. And I said, I love a great flying joke. So I went to that forum, and something that I read triggered the memory of what became my first story, which is, hey, pilot, I got to pee. And, you know, I don't want to give it away, but the title pretty much says it all. And what happened was I had absolutely no intention of writing a story, much less ever writing a book, much less writing what is now, so far, 4 books. I read this joke, whatever it was, that reminded me of, hey, pilot, I got to pee. And I said, ooh, I'll write this down, and that'll be my little contribution, and, you know, it'll just take a few minutes, and everybody will get a laugh, and off I'll go. So I started, you know, doing a reply post kind of thing, or, you know, post whatever it is. And after like 25 minutes, I'd written for 25 minutes, and I wasn't even airborne yet. I'm like, Jesus Christ, I'm thirsty. You know, I got to go to the bar. So I signed off and said, well, I'll have to finish this tomorrow because, you know, it's rum time. So I signed off and I posted it, and I went to my local watering hole and came back about, I don't know, 7-8 hours later, turned the computer back on, and there was like 3 or 4 responses to the post, and it was like, well, then what happened? And I'm like, yeah, okay. So the next day I wake up, and I said, yeah, maybe I'll finish this. I'll write another 20 minutes, and I'll be done. So I write another 20, 25, 30 minutes, and, you know, I'm still, you know, I'm airborne, but I'm just barely down the beach, and I'm going like, geez, I'm getting tired of writing. My head's pounding. I got a hangover. And I said, hey, you guys, you know, I got to go. I'll come back and finish this in a couple of days, and I went to the bar again. So I come home in another few hours, and I go back to the website, and there's a bunch more comments. And that's how it happened. And what I thought was going to be a quick 20-minute one-time post at most, you know, 15 to 20 minutes to tell this little story, one-time post, turned into, I think it was like 8 or 9, maybe even 10 installments over the course of like 2.5 weeks. And to tell the story, hey, pilot, I got to pee. And what is interesting and most meaningful, and one of the reasons that Cloud Dancer is Cloud Dancer, is somewhere after like the third installment, one of the comments that I got was from somebody up in Nome or Kotzebue or somewhere, and he simply wrote, "This guy's not making this shit up. He's been there, done that." Which, that comment just really hit me. I mean, it was, you know, it was a validation of what I was writing. And,
yep.
And it made me feel good. And I thought, wow, somebody, you know, because, I mean, all I've done, guys, is I've written down the same stories I've been telling in the cockpit for the last 25 years at my airline, and nobody believes them. And I think we talked about that before, Aiden. You said, you know, people in the lower 48 just don't believe this crap when we tell it to them, but it's really real.
Yeah,
and
no, somewhere down the line,
about the middle of the story, I got another post, a reply post on a thread from a guy who was definitely in Kotzebue, and I realized that he was literally 35 years after this story occurred to me, and I flew this flight 35 years later, this guy was operating the same airframes that I was operating 35 years earlier between the same villages. So I realized then, I had already started using the name Cloud Dancer because I wanted to be anonymous on the web, and I realized then that although these are my stories and all the stories in all four books are true, and actually in Volume 3, The Tragedies, I used the real names because I went to all the families and got permission to do so, although I didn't use my real name, but I used everybody else's real name. I realized that even though all these stories were all true and they all happened to me or me and my roommate, who's still flying up there, by the way, for one of the companies, so I won't mention him, but you guys will probably be able to figure it out. These stories belong to 7 or 8 or 10 or 12,000 pilots. These are the stories of 12,000 men and now women who have been doing the same thing since 1935. I am not a trailblazer. I set no new records. I did nothing extraordinary, really, that hadn't already been done 100 times before. I followed the guys who followed the guys who blazed the trail. And so that's why Cloud Dancer is Cloud Dancer and not somebody else, because Cloud Dancer is a lot of people.
Yep.
And that's where the books came from. Yeah, I got done with the first story, and I thought, thank God, I'm done with that. Jesus, it's been 10 weeks. And so I put the end, and I went to the bar. Son of a bitch, I came back from the bar, and there was like 4 people going, hey, tell us another one. And I'm like, geez, I didn't mean to write that one. And so then I started another story about a polar bear called Some Days You Get the Bear. And by far and away, I think that one's got like 28,000 hits.
Yeah, that's a good one. I like that one,
yeah,
actually.
I mean, that is the one that set the hook and got people started talking about Cloud Dancer's Alaskan Chronicles on the Internet. And then more and more people came. And then finally, after about 4 stories were posted, then the website operator decided he wanted me to have my own forum. And that's when Cloud Dancer's, that's when I came up with a name. But yeah, I had to have a name. So that's when it became Cloud Dancer's Alaskan Chronicles. And then after I had about 7 or 8 stories, people started bugging me to write a book. I said, write a book? I said, what for? And they said, well, we want to read the stories. And I said, well, what stories? They said, well, these stories. Put them in a book. And I'm like, why would I put them in a book? You're not going to buy them. He said, yeah, we will. I said, we already read them. They said, yeah, but we want to be able to carry them around and read them by the campfire, read them in a bathroom or whatever. And I'm like, are you serious? And it turns out they were serious.
Yeah. The thing I like, and sort of going back to what you said a little bit ago, where I think a lot of aviation writers would say the same, something similar to what you said, which is that they weren't necessarily breaking any new ground. There were lots of other pilots doing the same stuff. This goes back to even Fanning Cooperi, and your writing is a different style than his. But you've been very good at creating sort of an alter ego, Cloud Dancer, who can tell these stories in a very humorous and a stylized way, which is gets the stories across in almost a more real fashion than if you're telling them in a super serious manner.
For people that are thinking about whether or not these books might be interesting and they want to look at them, number one, the conversation that we've been having for the last whatever 25, 30 minutes, that's the way my book. That's the way my. I mean, you guys can tell them that's the way my books read, don't they?
They do, though. I can see all the situations that you get in, and I can recognize them as situations that, you know, you do get into fairly frequently up there, and so they all ring pretty true. One last thing I'd like to ask: do you have any aviation writers that you like that you've read in the past?
My two favorite aviation writers, whom I've read since I was a child, Ernie Gann.
Yep.
For any people out there that are aspiring to be an airline pilot or just any kind of a pilot, you should read Fate is the Hunter. As a matter of fact, if I were king, you could not get an air transport license without reading Fate is the Hunter and passing a 100-question test. Ernie Gann, Fate is the Hunter, and possibly my second favorite. Well, Fate is the Hunter I've read at least 20 times in my life. High and the Mighty I've read probably 10 or 12 times. And don't go see the movies. Oh, I'll see the movie. Bullshit. Get the book. Read the stinking book. Pick it up. I don't care if you get it on Kindle or whatever. Read the damn book if you want to be an airline pilot.
Yeah, they need to remake that movie, Fate is the Hunter, but the movie that's out there is really, I don't think, does the book any justice at all.
No, it didn't do the book any justice. It took a couple, you know, I mean, well, hey, it's a Hollywood adaptation of a book, and that's what happens. God only knows what a mess they're going to make out of Cloud Dancer when they finally get around to it. but, hey, pay me enough money and see if I care. No, that's not true. I really do care. My other favorite writer, and some of you may or may not know of him, Richard Bach. Have you ever read Richard Bach?
I'm going to turn you over to Mike on that one.
Yeah, I'm actually a huge fan of his. I had the pleasure of having lunch with him many years ago.
Oh wow! No kidding.
Yeah. I've actually written something about that experience that I will post on Oddball Pilot one of these days.
How cool. Well, you know, he had an accident a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, I did.
Well, interestingly, you know, the title, I forget what made me think of it, but the title of one of my favorite books of his, not the favorite, but one of them, is called Nothing by Chance. Have you read that one?
Yep.
Yep, I've read that one too.
Yep, fascinating. But of course, the one that most of your listeners might be most familiar with is Jonathan Livingston Seagull.
Yep.
And that is one case where I will allow you not to substitute the movie, but you can go see the movie. You should still read the book first, but you can go see the movie. Jonathan Livingston Seagull, the movie, and I don't know how they got these seagulls to do all the stuff they did, because, I mean, this was way before the computer-generated stuff. Mm-hmm. So how they got these seagulls to do these incredible things. But Jonathan Livingston Seagull speaks to the soul of flying, the spirit of flying. And for some of you, maybe you're just considering flying as a good way to make a living. And then for some of you like me, it's an art, it's your spirit, it's the essence of your being, which you have to outgrow eventually, and I'm starting to get there. But if your skills are never quite good enough, if you're always going to strive for perfection, granted you're going to have a day where you just don't care that much, but we all have those. That's human. But if all the rest of the time you're constantly striving for perfection in your flying, to be the smoothest, the most professional, burn the less fuel, just to be the best, then Jonathan Livingston's Seagull is a tremendous book and a tremendous movie. I have read Bach and Ernie Gann so many times that people in the highest unbelievable form of praise have told me that that's what my writing reminds them of, is Gann or Bach. And one guy even said Hans Christian Andersen, which was also a very high compliment. I don't think I'm a third of the writer, but I've read their books so many times that their styles definitely have influenced my writing. And just to be even on the same bookshelf with them is an incredible honor.
Cool. Excellent. Well, Mike, do you have anything to add at this point?
I guess the big question is, if somebody is interested in your books and they're not passing through Pilot House living rooms in Alaska, what's the best way for them to get a hold of your book? Or books, rather.
By all means, if for no other reason, because excerpts from all the stories and all the books are available free on my website, go to the website. Plus, there's a neat little slideshow on my website that I did while I was in Waikiki, Cloud Dancer, up on stage with the hula dancers and cloud dancers snorkeling in Hanama Bay. But go to my website, www.clouddancer.org, and remember, it's Cloud Dancer with two D's .org. And you can read excerpts from all the stories in all four books there. It's the only place that you can get autographed copies is at clouddancer.org. And they're available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and things like that. There are Kindle and Nook versions out there
A
Kindle and Nook kind of person. So, yeah. They're getting spread out, and this helps. And in case I want your listeners to know how much I appreciate the opportunity, not only to talk to them, but to talk to the two of you guys. And I really want to get a chance to get down face to face with you guys, because we'll just have so much fun.
Cool. On that note, I'm going to sign off here. So it's Aiden and Mike with OddballPilot.com sitting down with Cloud Dancer. I'd like to thank Cloudy for his time. And we're signing off.
Thank you, guys. See ya.
We hope you liked this interview. If you found it useful, visit oddballpilot.com for more stuff like it.